This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide.
Welcome to Layla Weighs In here on Intelligent Medicine. Thank you for joining me. If you'd like to see me or have a consultation with me, it's not necessary that you come to New York if you're not from the tri-state area or it's too far to travel. I do telephone consults. I have clients, patients all over the country. You can make an appointment by calling the office at 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. Grimaldi will set you up. For those of you who wish to send me questions, topics of interest, hear me weigh in on some issue regarding health, wellness, nutrition, email me to radioprogram@AOL.com. That's radioprogram@AOL.com. Now, I've written recently about this in the newsletter about IBS, the different causes of IBS. Irritable bowel syndrome can have many causes. It could be SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. It could be, and that small intestinal bacteria kind of pushing along into the large intestine and causing irritable bowel syndrome. It could be candida overgrowth, yeast, right? Irritable bowel syndrome can be caused by food allergy or intolerance. You know, it's not the usual suspect symptoms with allergies. It's not always a sneeze or hives or something like that, but some major gastrointestinal upsets. So you want to take note of, if you're suffering with any IBS type symptoms, keeping a food diary, checking when your symptoms happen, can be helpful. Now, IBS is being diagnosed more and more, but did you know that a lack of awareness or social taboos may prevent diagnosis and treatment of IBS? Now, you know that April, and I know we're in May, April was IBS Awareness Month, but it's worth talking about. It may come as a surprise to many, since it's often regarded as a trivial condition, but irritable bowel syndrome is one of the most prevalent and burdensome chronic conditions reported by patients. This is from the International Foundation for Functional Gastrointestinal Disorders. That's the International Foundation for Functional Gastrointestinal Disorders, IFFGD. I actually, I have the link to that. I sourced that in my IBS article. If you've missed it in the newsletter or you haven't subscribed, you could just go to drhoffman.com and in the search, type in IBS and you'll see articles there. So IBS is one of the most prevalent and burdensome chronic conditions reported by patients. An estimated 30 to 45 million in the United States, that's 10 to 15% of the population, are affected by IBS. It's been cited as the second leading cause of work absenteeism, second only to the common cold, and was found to cause those affected to restrict their personal and professional activities an average of 20% of the year. That's 73 days of the year. That's a lot. But despite the high prevalence and well-documented burden, much about IBS remains unknown, and myths and misconceptions about the disorder are common among patients as well as the general public. Despite being very common, many with IBS are reluctant to openly talk about their symptoms or seek medical care, said Cecile Rooker, president of the International Foundation for Functional Gastrointestinal Disorders, a registered nonprofit organization dedicated to improving the lives of people with IBS and other chronic GI disorders. They may feel uncomfortable discussing their symptoms, even with their doctor, because of social taboos surrounding bowel symptoms. Who wants to talk about poop and farts and gas and belching? You know, who wants to talk about it? People can feel embarrassed discussing that. Even with your doctor, you may feel embarrassed, but don't feel embarrassed talking to your doctor or nutritionist or other healthcare practitioner. That's what we're here for. So, this foundation is committed to raising awareness and breaking down taboos which may keep affected individuals from obtaining a diagnosis and receiving appropriate care. It's important to encourage open and honest conversation about IBS symptoms and quality of life issues, and remove barriers that may prevent those affected from enjoying a normal, active life. So, about irritable bowel syndrome, it's typically characterized by recurring or chronic bouts of abdominal pain in association with a change in bowel habit, such as diarrhea or constipation. And you can have alternating diarrhea and constipation. The pain may be relieved following a bowel movement and may be worsened after eating a meal. Complicating this, symptoms of IBS can flare up unexpectedly and can change over time or even from day to day. Other symptoms also occur, like bloating, gas, urgency. I encourage you to talk to your practitioner about it. There are many things to do. Tests that are offered for SIBO, for Candida, a good look at food allergies, intolerances, other functional ways to treat this with complementary and, you know, complementary medicine and nutrition. That's really what we do. It's integrative. It's integrative medicine and nutrition. And first, it's about eliminate. You know, you go to your mainstream doctor, you tell them you have IBS, and they might give you a prescription. They may give you a prescription for Prozac. Why Prozac? Guess what? It could work. You may be given an antidepressant because 90% of serotonin is produced in the gut. IBS may be related to a bit of a lack of serotonin, and the antidepressant often can solve that problem. But is that the real cause of the IBS? First, we need to look at other things. Are you eating too many low-carb products that contain sugar alcohols? Are you consuming too much xylitol? That's a sugar alcohol. Are you overdoing it on FODMAPs, fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols? Are you overdoing it in this department? Are you overdoing smoothies and things? Are you getting way too much fiber? There's a such thing as too much fiber. You know, we don't all have the same gut. We don't all have the same tolerance. So it's important to look at all these. IBS is often solved when you take care of the underlying cause. That cause could be food allergy. It could be as simple as removal of the FODMAP foods, which cause then any proliferation of bad bacteria to die. Eliminating sugar is important. Maybe there's some medication you're taking that's causing IBS symptoms. Many medications may cause constipation or diarrhea. If you're somebody who just started taking metformin, it's common to have diarrhea in the first few days or even weeks of taking metformin until your body readjusts. It could be any host of things. Maybe your IBS is caused by self-prescribing yourself nutraceuticals, vitamins, minerals, micronutrients. Maybe you're taking aloe gel and vitamin C and too much fish oil and magnesium, and you're wondering why you have this diarrhea and urgency and bloating. It could be the things that you're taking. The first order of business is to stop everything that you're taking and then see what ensues. A qualified practitioner can help you with this. A qualified nutritionist can help you do all of that. If you'd like to make an appointment with me, 212-779-1744. I treat IBS a lot. A lot. We just see it as very prevalent. You know, back 10 years ago, it was the diagnosis of exclusion. I think it's still a diagnosis of exclusion. You know, they'll send you for a colonoscopy. They won't find anything, thankfully. They won't find anything. You're fine. Maybe it's in your head. Or maybe they're prescribing that antidepressant because all that GI upset is causing you to be down. Of course it is. Who wants that kind of discomfort? To not be able to function up to 20% of the year, 73 days a year. That's a lot. Nobody should have to endure that. So, you can be treated for IBS. It does not have to be something that you live with. I urge you to get it taken care of. Moving on. You hear me often talk about low-carb diet and how it could solve a lot of problems. Well, this isn't quite a low-carb diet, but it's in the right direction. But let me give this context. Low versus high carbohydrate diet in type 1 diabetes. This is a 12-week randomized open-label crossover study. Type 1 diabetes means you are taking insulin. And type 1 diabetics often have to, quote, feed, end quote, their insulin dose. It should really be the other way around. That when you lower the amount of carbohydrate, when you lower the amount of insulin, you can do a lower carbohydrate. It should go hand in hand that way. You should not have to feed a big load of insulin that you've self-administered. You can taper down the amount of insulin you take by tapering the carbohydrates in your diet. It's been done, and people have done very, very, very well. The drawback to taking all this insulin, because if you're seeing your doctor or a mainstream nutritionist who's telling you all about, you know, carbohydrate counting, but you must eat at least 200 carbohydrates or you'll die, 200 grams of carbs or you'll die, so you have to take this much insulin. The problem with taking that much insulin is you get fat and you can't lose the weight. And guess what? All that insulin is a promoter of inflammation, propagates inflammation, down the road may feed a cancer. So coming back to this, to compare the effects of a low-carb diet and what their definition in this study of a low-carb diet is less than 100 grams of carbs a day versus a high-carb diet. And that high-carb diet is defined in this as greater than 250 grams of carbs a day. And what this does to glycemic control and cardiovascular risk factors in adults with type 1 diabetes. So, in a randomized crossover study with two 12-week intervention arms separated by a 12-week washout, 14 participants using sensor-augmented insulin pumps were included. This is a small study. It was 14 participants. Individual meal plans meeting the carbohydrate criteria were made for each study participant. Actual carbohydrate intake was entered into the insulin pumps throughout the study. So what are the results? Of the 14 participants, 10 completed the study. Daily carbohydrate intake during the two intervention periods, 98 plus or minus 11 grams of carbs for the low carb diet and 246 plus or minus 34 grams of carbs for the high carb diet, respectively. Okay. So what they found out is that compared with an intake of 250 grams of carbohydrate per day, restriction of carbohydrate intake to 100 grams per day in adults with type 1 diabetes reduced time spent in hypoglycemia, which often happens in people who take insulin, because they must feed the insulin or they will get very hypoglycemic. You know, if you administer insulin and you don't eat immediately, and you've administered quite a bit of insulin, you could go into insulin shock. The blood sugar is so low. You can faint. You may even have a seizure. So, compared with an intake of 250 grams of carbs per day, restriction of carbohydrate intake to 100 grams per day in adults with type 1 diabetes reduced the time spent in hypoglycemia. Not just that, it reduced time in hypoglycemia, glycemic variability, and weight with no effect on cardiovascular risk factors. So, this is actually in Diabetes, Obesity, Metabolism. This is from March 2019, ahead of print. Diabetes, Obesity, Metabolism. When I printed it up, it was ahead of print. Okay. So, although it's a small study, but listen, they call a low-carb diet 100 grams. You go to 50 grams. You go to 40 grams. You go to 20 grams. As Dr. Bernstein has done, the famous diabetes doctor who himself has type 1 diabetes, Dr. Hoffman has talked of him often. There are wonderful ways to be able to control it when you lower the amount of carbs. Then you get your blood sugar ranges far less variable. You have a tighter control of blood sugar, and that's what you want. You don't want lows and highs. They are terrible for your health. And the lows could be a medical emergency if the hypoglycemia is so severe that you pass out or have a seizure or worse. You want very tightly controlled blood sugar. And you do that by tightly controlling the amount of carbs you eat so that you're able to administer the least amount of insulin possible and still be healthy, functioning, all of that. And of course, taking into consideration the amount of physical activity, the exercise you get, all of that kind of thing. That's also very, very important. When you're a type 1 diabetic, you have to take all of that into account. Because the more physical activity that you partake in, the more you have to watch in terms of your feeding, the amount of insulin you take, and all of that. This is all very important. So, again, and this seems to be a new novel idea of treating people with type 1 diabetes with a low-carb diet. We've been doing that for, a couple of decades. I have. And again, if you're a type 1 diabetic, you need strict supervision with this. You don't want to embark on this yourself. There's a big learning curve when you're migrating from a very high-carb diet, as you may have been told by your mainstream doctor and nutritionist who thinks you will die without carbs, or that many carbs. You need supervision and education as you transition over from a very high carb diet to the low carb diet that you should be on, to have tighter blood sugar regulation, less chance of hypoglycemia, and a long, healthy life with the lowest amount of insulin you can self-administer as possible. This is always the goal. In those with type 1 diabetes, we want to reduce the amount of insulin. I've had so many type 1 diabetics come into my office. They're overweight. They are puffy. It's all that insulin they're taking because they were advised on the wrong way of eating. You must eat 200 grams of carbohydrates a day or you will die. You must have so many slices of bread and glasses of milk and pieces of fruit. I'm referring to the carbohydrate counting graph that we were all taught as dietitians. But there is a much better way, I promise you. Type 1 diabetes can be much better and more tightly controlled with the least amount of hypoglycemia and much better health outcomes on a lower carb diet. So keep this in mind. I want to thank you for joining me on another edition of Layla Weighs In, here on Intelligent Medicine.
This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Protocol for Life Balance line of professional-grade supplements. One of the most important indicators of good health is your body composition, the proportion of fat and fat-free mass in your body. Having a healthy body composition promotes healthy blood pressure, heart health, and a healthy glucose metabolism. Our friends at Protocol for Life Balance have a trio of products designed to deliver effective body comp support with a variety of vital natural compounds that support appetite management, energy, healthy adrenal response, and more. Go to drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance for more information. That's drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance.
This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients regularly along with Dr. Hoffman. If you require a nutrition consult with me but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.